Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen. Today we have Larry Widman, a high-performance mindset coach and the author of Max Out Mindset. Larry, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
So to start, can you tell our listeners what the book is about and why it's relevant to volleyball coaches in particular?
Yeah, I mean, the book has just been about my experiences over the past 20 years working with high-performing teams, you know, businesses, leaders, but in particular, most of it's through the lens of sport and often through the lens of volleyball because that's the world I live in. But the book is just my experiences of what I've done with teams and how I've worked with teams and also what I've learned from teams over the years and some of the great coaches I've been around. And, you know, I organize the book in a way that hopefully helps people understand how to max out their mind as part of the overall high-performance stool, and organize it in a way to sort of make sure you max out your mind, max out your emotions. If you're on a team, max out your team. And first off, you got to prepare your mind for battle. So I have it organized with each there's 15 different powers or ingredients, and each one of those ingredients I feel is something that if you learn it, grow from it, can help you, what I say, max out when it matters the most. Because I always say, if you can't do it when it matters, what's the point?
Yeah, that is when it matters. So then in the beginning of the book, you talked about, the famous Viktor Frankl, who wrote the great book, Man's Search for Meaning. And, you know, he's a Holocaust survivor. And I think that book's, affected a lot of people's lives. But I guess I'm wondering, how did you take that and translate his ideas to elite performance?
Yeah, I mean, he's an interesting man. You know, he actually was a psychiatrist who was practicing and then was put in a concentration camp in the Holocaust, and his whole family perished, including his wife, and came out and wrote Man's Search for Meaning. But, just thinking about the foundation, for me, my foundational philosophy and his quote, you know, between stimulus and response, there's a space, and that space is the power to choose your response. You know, is everything I think of when I think of mental resilience or grit. In essence, you know, his quote about the stimulus or an event that happens in the sporting world, obviously, it could be, you know, you shanked a ball, it could be a bad call by the ref, it could be a teammate saying something to you that was frustrating. And to me, it's all about how do you get on to the next moment, the next point, the next play, and how do you handle that emotionally? Because you have a power, I feel like, through mental skills and mindfulness, we can train the brain to have a little larger space. So in the animal world, you get fight or flight when there's something that happens, right, to you. Human beings, because we have this front part of our brain, I feel like we can train that to have just a little extra space, whether you're stuck in traffic and decide, am I going to lose my mind in traffic when I get cut off, or am I going to take a deep breath and turn up the music and say it's not that big a deal, or, you know, when I shank a ball, am I going to go negative on myself and beat myself up, or am I going to use my technical cues and my performance words, talk to my coach and teammates, and get on to the next point? So I really do believe how you handle the stimulus by what response you pick really has everything to do with how healthy you are in sport and life.
Can you take us through maybe a coach who's trying to teach a player how to have that space in practice, like what a conversation would look like? Would it be identifying when they're getting frustrated and kind of guiding them towards having that moment to calm down, or what would that conversation sound like?
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, I could probably use one example because I talked about it in my book and she's talked about it too. But back in 2015, there was an athlete named Kelsey Feen at Nebraska. She's an outside hitter from California. And one of the things that she struggled with was getting on to the next point. So she would make repeat mistakes. But you could tell that she was struggling because she had terrible body language. And I always say that body language is sort of the window into your self-talk. Because if you think about it, when your body language is terrible, you're usually talking to yourself pretty negatively. Beating yourself up. And so, you know, it became conversations both, you know, on the side, one-on-one, like what can you do in that moment? So as a coach who's there more often with them, to be able to talk to them about what's happening in that moment when you start to slump your shoulders and shake your head and mutter to yourself, like, what are you really saying to yourself? So then you have these honest conversations with the athlete, because if you don't ask, maybe you've made an assumption it's something else, that they're just weak. But if they're beating themselves up, now you have a chance to say, what are you saying to yourself? Does that help you? Right? And then what kind of strategies can you put in place instead of that? Right? So I had Jordan Larson on my podcast not very long ago, and we talked about self-talk. That's the number one thing she struggles with. But so what she said is, look, I have awareness when my self-talk starts to go, when it starts to hurt my performance, and then I have a strategy to do something about it. Awareness, strategy. So with Kelsey, you know, she had a couple of different strategies, but what was really interesting about her, she came up with a phrase that she got, one of her mistakes was hitting it long. Oftentimes, and she would get so frustrated, and she would start to say to herself, that's just Husker power. The Husker power was a phrase made famous by strength and conditioning in football, meaning that she just has so much strength in her, that's why she hit it long. Now, she knows that wasn't what it was, but it gave her a chance to kind of take a deep breath, not laugh, but kind of just make it a little lighter and then think, all right, what do I need to do technically? Or what kind of advice can I get from my coach or my setter or somebody else to help me move on to the next point, rather than just get into our internal space and just by the time we're ready to go again, we haven't even lined up, we haven't talked to our setter, and you know, next point comes up and we, you know, we hit it long again, or we, you know, or we hit it into the net. So it's really about a coach understanding the problem and then coming up with helping them with strategies. But as you know, coaches, that's not one of their strengths, most of them. So that's why I think it's fun to collaborate with a coach and give them strategies so they can implement them with the player. But ultimately, we've got to replace our negative self-talk with something, performance words, technical cues, positive mantra, something to help us move on.
And do you think this role that you're talking about, you know, whether it's a coach or someone like you stepping in, is it more beneficial when it is the coach doing it, or do you think it's better to have someone separate, like a sports psychologist coming in and working with the player? I guess, where do you see that, which person can kind of have the bigger impact?
Oh, by far the coach. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, cause they're there all the time. So it's more of a collaborative thing where, you know, I may spend a lot more time with the athlete trying to understand what are they saying? Why are they saying it? You know, what other things are impacting why they're so hard on themselves, so that you can start to get them into solution mode. You know, coaches don't usually either have that much time or that much interest in working through that process, but of course they want their athlete to be confident and to be able to move on. So, you know, it's more me working in collaboration where I can help in practice is just more observing. Like I don't know if I've ever interfered in the middle of a practice to go talk to somebody and, you know, when coach should be talking to them. But right. I might talk to them on the side if they've been out of a drill and just say, hey, you know. But most of the time it's, you know, it's the coaches and maybe a teammate or two that can really help them. But the coach needs to understand what's happening inside of them or they misinterpret, you know. I had a coach, you know, Coach Cook, you know, he's really not a yeller or a screamer like some people think. He's actually very calm most of the time, but he got on his team once at the end of set two in the locker room, and he kind of got on one of the girls and raised her voice, and she just wouldn't stop crying. And he was like, came to me and goes, I don't know what's wrong with her. I mean, I've never seen her act like this. And I said, well, did you ask her? And he said, no. I said, well, maybe we should find out. And it turns out that she had an extremely verbally abusive father. Mm-hmm. And he never raises his voice, Coach Cook. And when he yelled, she heard her father. She heard her father's voice and she just went into trauma mode and she couldn't stop crying. Well, that's a great thing for a coach to know versus, oh, what's wrong with her? Is she just being a baby? She's just not strong. Like once he understood that, you know, that traumatized her, you know, he could choose to yell at her again, or raise his voice. But you know what? If you're an evolved coach, you decide, how am I going to do this different or better with that particular athlete? So where I can help is more with the insight and maybe some suggestions about how to deal with it. And the coach has to take over because, you know, they're there and that's the person that needs to make the decisions and help.
Nice. And what role do you see optimism playing in sports?
Well, I just think it's huge. I mean, part of it is it overlaps in what I call hope, you know, and hope is one of the, what we call psychological assets of grit, you know, grit meaning mental resilience, same thing, sort of how do you handle adversity and move on despite difficult circumstances. And so where I find it really important is one, optimism, I think, is a competitive advantage. It is rooted in positive psychology and gratitude, but it's rooted in hope that the next moment or the next day is going to be better. Now, Pete Carroll from the Seattle Seahawks had a real cool quote, and I may not get it perfectly right, but he said, you know, the world trains people to be pessimistic. And he said one of his most important things that he has to do is make sure that his players and staff that believe tomorrow will be a better day. And, you know, when things are tough, you guys are athletes. I mean, in the moment sometimes, or even a little bit longer, you feel like things are just falling apart. And, you know, where optimism comes into play is that's often being trained by the coach or your team leaders to sort of keep things in perspective, let you understand that things are going to get better, that things are difficult, but, you know, the skill, I wasn't expecting you to be perfect at it yet. So it's very difficult to have mental resilience if there isn't optimism, because the opposite of that is, you know, pessimism and negativity. And I'm a big believer in what I call positive psychology, meaning, you know, Coach Osborne from Nebraska, he was a football coach there, pretty famous AD and congressman. You know, he said the best way to change behavior is to catch somebody doing something right and reinforcing that. Right. So to me, that's about optimism too, which is you're catching people doing things right. It doesn't mean you don't hold people accountable. It doesn't mean that you don't have a certain amount of criticism. You just don't make it personal, but spend more of your energy in an optimistic framework. And that leads to increased hope, increased grit. And ultimately what I see is a competitive advantage when the goals we set and the work we do to get better is hard.
So yeah, I think players a lot of times will take on the personality of their coach. And I think of Pete Carroll, you know, very optimistic guy. But I think sometimes people think, oh, optimism, pessimism, that's just innate. That's what you are. I don't know. Do you have ideas on like how a coach, if they do value optimism and maybe they aren't always that optimistic, are there ways they can train it or, you know, approach things more optimistically?
Yeah, I think some of it's an awareness that, you know, that if you study the science behind it, that, you know, the best performers, best coaches have about a 3-to-1 ratio of praise to criticism. That's in the business world. That's in the marriage world. That's in on teams. So first off, understanding the science and the research that, you know, we're not burying our head in the sand, right? And we're not making it all optimistic every moment, but having a framework that it's more important to think through things optimistically. And then of course you still have to hold people accountable, right? So it's an awareness tool. I can tell you early on in my experience with Coach Cook, working with him, the players would come up to me at practice. I'd go 3 days a week and they'd say, can you come to practice every day? And I'd kind of say, well, why? They say, well, coach is completely different when you're here. And I said to that, so I asked coach, I said, what do they mean by that? He says, you know, they're right. He says, when I see you, you're my awareness tool that I need to take a deep breath. And I need to not, you know, blow my whistle so quickly out of frustration or get angry, that there are times to get that way, but that I have to flip the ratio a little bit. So sometimes it's just an awareness for coaches that, hey, try it out. Maybe you can get more out of your players than you ever imagined. You know, that's a challenge when you're a successful coach and you say, it's always, my way has always worked, or this is the way I'm going to do it. And if they don't like it, too bad. My experience has been the opposite with the coaches I'm around lately, is that they're willing to evolve and look at things and say, you know what, I don't have it all figured out. And there has to be different ways to reach different people. And maybe that's why my team is sort of in a plateau, you know, which is what some of Coach Cook's teams had done in the early 2010s. It was kind of plateau or backtrack just slightly.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that, the evolve idea, and coaches always pushing themselves, even when they do have success, like you said, that's hard to do. Then how about for a player who wants to train, you know, obviously I think lots of times as players, we have this negative bias and we notice all the bad. So how can we train, this powerful tool of optimism?
Well, I mean, again, I mean, there's some mental skills. I mean, what I call the building blocks of an elite mindset, you know, I call them goal setting, self-talk, arousal, control, visualization. Those are the four, along with mindfulness, that I would say are the building blocks that lead to the ingredients of an elite mind. And so you got to start there and think about how do those impact optimism. So first you have to, like anything, awareness tool to athletes. This awareness, like what I said with Jordan Larson or lots of the great athletes, to say, when I sit in that negativity or pessimism, does that help my performance? Rather than just sit in it and then at the end of the day go, I wonder why I didn't perform well or why did I choke? So some of it is awareness. Some of it is the awareness that's trainable. Because, you know, I think my big growth in this area is when I was able to explain to people not only the science but the art of it, meaning that anything we're going to talk about is trainable. So, because they're used to saying, all right, if I want to get stronger or jump higher, here's my prescription from the strength coach or the nutritionist. Or if I want to get better with my passing, here's a prescription from the coach. Here's the drills I'm going to do. And then the coach says to you, maybe you've heard this, and he'll say, I just need you to relax. And the athlete's like, well, if I knew how to relax, coach, I would. How do I do it? And the coach is like, well, I don't know, just figure it out. Or I need you to be mentally tougher. And then the athlete's like, well, I don't know how to be mentally tougher. What do I do? And the coach is like, I don't know, figure it out. So my job is to make sure for the coaches and athletes that anything we talk about is trainable. So there's a prescription. So if you want to improve confidence, you know, for your mindset, here's some ingredients to get there, right? And so here are the building blocks. So how do we first, what's the role of self-talk in performance? What are the strategies to change our self-talk if we don't know? You know, so there's positive mantras, you know, there's performance or instruction words, motivational words. Sometimes I say it's just get external with your teammate. It can be a form of self-talk. If you try using your words and they're not helping you and you're sitting in, you know, feeling bad for yourself and you suck and I'm no good, start talking to a teammate. Get external. That's a form of self-talk to me. So teach them strategies. So awareness of why it impacts your performance, how it can help your performance, and then what do you do about it? So for optimism, part of it's self-talk. Some of it can be, well, how else can I train to get extra mental reps? Oh, I can teach you how to visualize or do imagery. That gives you confidence and optimism that you put in more work in your mind. Mindfulness training does a great job of helping people stay more optimistic. So you try to give them science-based strategies or at least strategies that are rooted in high performance that will actually train optimism. And then, of course, you've got it. That's what I call the inside out, you training it yourself. And then outside in is your coaches, your teachers, you know, your bosses. They can help train optimism in you, right? I mean, and again, if you've had a number of coaches, as you guys being athletes, there's some coaches that can easily help you get more optimistic, and there's some that can fuel your negativity even more, and you can all sit in that together. So a coach has a huge role in training that. Because I always say the coach has got to model the behaviors they want. If you want your those that you lead to do something, stay calm, be positive, be fearless, be optimistic. If you don't model that for those that you lead, how can you expect them to do it? So I'm a big believer that you need to model every behavior that you want from your team as a leader.
Yeah, that's a great message, important one to remember. So for you mentioned real quickly there, mindfulness. I know that's a big word that's thrown around a lot now. It's become more popular. Are there ways that you found it's most effective to implement for maybe the Nebraska team or for a college team?
Yeah, so I'll give you one formal way that we do it. It's pretty common. And I'll give you one informal one just because one of the teams really bought into this on their own. So, I mean, mindfulness to me is about being present or aware, awareness of how we're thinking physically and mentally and emotionally and, you know, how we're feeling so that we know that if we're in a negative space or if we're too hyped up or if we're not hyped up enough. So, you know, the best I think of mindfulness is being in the present moment. And if you think about what the best in this world do in any endeavor, best surgeon, best teacher, best athlete, best coach, they spend more time in the present moment, not too focused in the past, not too worried about the future. There's times for those, but more locked in onto the next moment, the next play, and very focused. And, you know, you can train that in mindfulness. So I like to have people focus on something. So the breath is the easiest thing that I know. I teach what I call just a mindfulness breathing. So just closing your eyes, getting in a quiet space, and just breathing normally, either paying attention to your breath as it goes in through your nose and out through your nose or out through your mouth, however you breathe, or counting your breaths. A lot of people like to count them. So each time they just take a breath, they say the word one and then two. And then when their mind gets distracted, so we're having them focus on something like their breath. You could focus on a mantra, you could focus on a light, but close your eyes, focus on your breathing. And then the goal is not to have a quiet mind. So people think the goal is to have a quiet mind. So they're like, I'm no good at this because their mind is always wandering. So they go, I quit doing it, doc, because I'm no good at it. I'm like, well, did you know the goal is not to have a quiet mind? It's to be focal, have a focal point. When your mind gets distracted, have an awareness it's distracted to what am I having for lunch or, oh my God, what's going on in practice today? And go, I got to bring it back to my focus point. Because I always ask athletes, I say, you know, what's one of the things that athletes do better than others when it comes to concentration? They say focus. I said, the real truth is what the best do is focus, but then they have the ability to refocus because we're having nothing but distractions in sport, right? Bad call, we shake a ball, lots of noise, weather, and our brain gets distracted from being locked in and we have to be able to bring it back. So mindfulness training to me is about focus, refocus. And so I can get bought by in for my athletes because of that. So, so that's what I call a formal training of mindfulness, the breath. I whiteboarded out with one of the women's gymnastics team a couple of years ago at Nebraska. Let's think about all the informal things you could do. Anything from surfing to listening to music to, and the one that they decided to pick to do the night before every competition on the day of, adult coloring books, right? Which was really interesting. I saw one of them doing it on an airplane and I asked her, why are you doing this? And she said, I have a lot of nervousness on the plane and it helps me relax. And I said, maybe you should bring that up when we do this whiteboard exercise. So I didn't think they would pick it. But they decided that that was very relaxing. So, but again, in order to make it a mindful activity, you have to have truly focus on coloring within the lines. And when your mind gets distracted, you bring it back to coloring in the lines, right? I always say biking, running, doing gardening can all be mindful unless the whole time you're doing it, you're worried about an argument you had with somebody earlier in the day or a project you have tomorrow. And if you're not in a mindful state, well, then you just blew that activity. So you have to have some intention behind it. So the informal activity for the women's team was doing adult coloring books for 10 minutes. And they loved it. And they felt like it made a big difference in calming them. And then, at the end of the day, for me, what I've really gotten buy-in from the athletes is there's four benefits from mindfulness. It's improved focus, improved memory, the ability to stay calm under stress, and increased kindness. And I go through them with them. How can you not be a better student athlete in person if you do better in those four areas, right? Especially in this world today with political and societal and COVID, and to have increased kindness in this world. I mean, meditators are proven to be more compassionate, and there's brain changes that have taken place that we never believed were possible. The brain actually changes size in a couple of areas, and one of them is in an area that improves compassion. So it's made sense why people have used it in the Eastern world for 3,000 years. I just needed to understand the science and then translate it to the athletes so they could say, how does mindfulness really help me? Why am I going to commit to 10 or 20 minutes a day? And it's pretty powerful tool, and it's free and you can do it anywhere. And most of the high-level athletes I know have built a mindfulness practice into their routine.
That's a great message. In the book, you also talk about a study where some different institutions set out to understand the secrets to building effective teams. And I know Google thought before the study even started that they could just combine the best people. What happened when those superstar teams, when they were formed?
Yeah, so that was our hypothesis. Put the best and the brightest together, you'll get the best teams, right? So I always tell people two examples real quickly. One, in the business world, there was a hedge fund called Long Term Capital Management back in the 90s. They put all the best and the brightest, Nobel Prize winners, you know, Wall Street geniuses, and because of some monetary changes in Russia, different places, their fund went busted to such a degree that the United States had to bail them out because they had like $1 trillion on the line because it was such a hedge. And I would say, and this isn't a knock on Penn State at all, very successful program, but it's interesting because their women's team in 2014 had just come off four straight national titles, and they had what they were considered the best recruiting class in the history of the NCAA. And I was, at least in my world, Nebraska, I think, had gone maybe 1-10 against them in the prior 5 years. Nebraska went 7-0 against that recruiting class. And I don't know all the factors, but a lot of times when you put the best and the brightest together in that respect, it doesn't always produce the best sport teams either. There's different roles, and sometimes there's too many superstars on a team. Jordan Larson told me about a team in 2007 where they had a hard time embracing their roles. They had two former national players of the year on the same squad, and I'm sure there are a lot of factors why they underperformed, but one of them was that I think they had too many, maybe best and the brightest, and not a good enough healthy mix. But that's what Google found, was that you don't put there's they found four or five things that were really important for teams, but that wasn't one of them. It wasn't the highest IQ, it wasn't the people with the most experience, it wasn't the people that had been making the most money, it wasn't any of those things.
So then what ingredients did Google find crucial?
Yeah, so they found five ingredients. The bottom two were impact and meaning, and those are kind of words that most people would expect, that, you know, you feel like you're making an impact on the organization or the team, or that it has a personal meaning to you. You know, I mean, number three to me is what they call structure and clarity, which to me, I think is really important on a team, meaning who sets that? That's the coach, you know, the structure, making sure people understand what practice is going to be like, they know what to expect from their coach every day, but, you know, what the road's going to be like and what their day-to-day is going to be like, and that everyone understands their role. So the structure and role clarity are really important for business teams and athletic teams. Two is the term they call dependability. And essentially, that is just doing a really great job, or what I would call just do your job. One of my partners, Danny Woodhead, who's a former NFL guy, he played for the Patriots, and he said their number one value that Bill Belichick set was do your job. And sometimes we forget, you know, that I don't have to do someone else's job. I just have to do my job well, but I better do it. But despite all those things I just told you, there was only one thing that really stood out. It was a term called psychological safety. That was the ingredient they found out that if a team had that, that's where the best teams were when they studied it at Google, was what they call psychological safety.
Yeah, I think Daniel Coyle, I think that was the first time I heard it in his book, The Culture Code, talking about that as well. But yeah, I guess why was that so important? Why is psychological safety the most important thing for teams?
Yeah. Well, one is that the definition sort of is that the team members feel safe to take risks and be vulnerable in front of each other. So when you think about just that alone, in order to have psychological safety on a team, you have to have built some trust and relationships. And so sometimes it's better thinking of it the other way. Like if you've ever been on a team where you didn't feel safe, where your coach humiliated you or embarrassed you in front of people, or your teammates did the same or shunned you or bullied you, more people can remember what it's like when they've been on a team, either in school or an athletic team, where they didn't feel safe to voice their opinion. Or, for example, a coach says, hey, throw out some ideas to me on this. And one raises their hand and they throw out an idea. And he's like, that's just one of the stupidest things I've ever heard. Right? Well, the next athlete might have a really great idea. You think they're going to raise their hand? They're like, I'm not saying anything now. So then what happens in a dangerous situation is nobody wants to give an opinion. Right. And so, and then more importantly, we want to blame others when we make mistakes. We don't want to admit to it because coach is going to come after us, even if we screw up in something he doesn't know. And then the more important thing is people that are in psychologically dangerous situations, they don't learn how to handle failure. They don't embrace it. And so in the safe world, it's just the opposite. But that takes work. You just don't get on a team that and form a team together that's brand new or evolves and have enough safety automatically. You have to spend time building deeper relationships. To me, that leads to trust, and you have to be willing to show vulnerability through either exercises or through, and so the coach has got to model that for the team, but the coach has really got to create that safe space for a team to feel like if the coach humiliates or embarrasses us in practice or somewhere else, we're never going to get there. Or if our team leaders do the same to the freshmen, you know, so, it makes complete sense to me working with teams where I say the goal for me is to get a team to ultimate trust, that without psychological safety, you can't get there.
And then another study was with MIT did. What did they find that separated the best teams other than have women on the teams?
Yeah, so number three was having more women on the teams, which is really
smart. Interesting. That's smart.
So, but number one was this notion that you have this high degree of social sensitivity to each other. And I call that emotional intelligence. Sort of this awareness of how people are thinking and feeling that you can kind of tell from their body language or facial expressions or the way they're sitting that you may say, hey, I can tell something's wrong with them. And then you actually ask them, hey, what's up today? Versus this sort of being internal where you're not even aware that somebody's hurting today or something bad happened, or you just assume that they're, you know, just a negative person and you didn't even think, well, hey, maybe they got some bad news today. So this ability to just be aware of other people and how they're feeling and thinking is really powerful. I think that's why number three, more women in the group, is there too, because women tend to be more emotionally intelligent on average. Doesn't mean you can't train it. And then two, which I thought was what I find really interesting, is that the teams that were the best for them, they gave roughly equal time to each other. So maybe on a particular assignment, somebody who had more expertise, you know, maybe took the lead, but over time, there were no what we call superstars and no slackers. That everybody on the team felt comfortable and were willing to participate relatively equally. That's what MIT found.
Cool. And I think one of my favorite things about the book was the exercises you gave the team, and you kind of described those. And I, as a coach listening, it said, oh, I'd love to try some of this with my team. Was there a certain assignment or exercise you did that you'd like to share that had a big impact on the teams?
Yeah, I would tell you the one that I think is the best one I've ever come up with. And I know it's true because Coach Cook said he wished he had come up with it himself. And that you need a little backstory on this, just in the sense that, you know, Coach Cook had won two national titles his first 6 years and had a great Final Four run in 08. And then from 2009 to 14, he made the Elite Eight every year except for one, but hadn't made a Final Four. And he knew that things were, you know, maybe slightly backtracking a little. And he finally came up with the awareness, maybe in a sense that he needed to do some things different through, you know, some of the work I did with him and his coaches. But I always said, too, that the ladies had to work on things. So I was actually sitting at a spring practice in the spring of 15. And I don't think it just was a stressful practice. And I was sitting next to Lindsay Peterson, who's the director of operations, who won a national title on his team in the year 2000. And I said, okay, how did you do it, Lindsay? And she said, how did we do it? I said, how did you win it all? I said, same coach, right? Same expectations, same pressure, same sellouts. All the things are the same. How did you do it? And she said, that's a great question. She let me think about it. And I said, how many teams do you think maxed out at Nebraska in those first 14 years? We came up with the two title teams. And then he had a team in 2008 that made the Final Four that almost took down Penn State that hadn't lost a set all year and completely maxed out. I said, once she told me a few things, I said, hey, why don't we see about if we can get the ladies on the 15 team to call any of the ladies who are willing from the 0 team, the 16, and the 18, and ask them a series of questions and anything they want as well. But ultimately, we needed to know, how did you win it all? How did you max out? What were your ingredients? And we got 38 ladies from those three former teams. And I always say it's better when they can learn from people they can relate to than the short bald guy, right? So they got to call, each got to call two athletes and ask them a series of questions that I had come up with and anything they wanted to ask, but ultimately learning those things. And, you know, Jordan Larson and Caleb Banworth, all these Olympians. And then we sat down and whiteboarded it out. What did we learn about those teams? Why were they able to max out? Because that way we took Coach Cook out of the equation. And not because in a negative way, but if they saw Coach Cook as stressful at times to them or hard on them or whatever, well, he had other teams that maxed out, right? So I wanted to take away all the things they didn't have control over and find out what they did have control over. And what we learned was this, in whiteboarding it out, only two things came out, honestly. I mean, 35 of the 38 ladies came up with both of these. The teams that maxed out embraced their roles, and we learned to build deeper relationships and love each other. That was it. And what we didn't anticipate, or I didn't think about, but I should have, was that, you know, every one of those ladies were on other teams. And they all told us that the 2001 team had more talent than the 2000 team. The 2007 team at Nebraska, they said, was the best in history. Two former players of the year. I mean, all Americans in every position, and they get knocked out early. So the teams around those great teams also had teams that were better talent-wise that didn't max out, and they were able to tell the ladies why they didn't max out, didn't embrace our roles. We didn't invest enough in each other to build relationships. And ultimately why that became so powerful, so I'll close it with this. So I love that exercise because one, developed a mentoring relationship. They got to learn from former athletes who were in their exact same shoes, you know, went well to help them max out, and also what helped some of their teams fall short. So that summer at fall camp, Coach Cook had moved Amber Alston, one of the twins, from right side to middle. And she wasn't that thrilled about it, as you can imagine, right? But anyway, so that happens right after we do this assignment. 3 weeks into the season, after Texas beats him, he moves the other twin, Katie Ralston, from left side to right. And anyone in the volleyball world knows what that can do to an ego or frustration, right? And then he moves Michaela Fecky from right to left because he felt that gave the team the best chance to win. And so Michaela, they both become first-team All-Americans. Michaela wins the MVP of the national title game. But they also were able to say, oh, my gosh, we have to embrace our roles because that's what these other great ladies just told us we have to do. And maybe they would have done it anyway, but maybe they wouldn't have. Maybe they would have sulked or gotten frustrated. And instead, they got over it quick. they were able to accept that, hey, other great athletes here have done the same thing. And it was pretty rewarding to know that after the season, that's pretty much what they talked about at the press conference, was how much that exercise with mentoring relationships had to do with them embracing their roles and building relationships with each other. So, and building psychological safety and ultimate trust. So that's kind of a long-winded version of an exercise that I'll never forget. And it was powerful. Had they not won it, it would have still been powerful.
Yeah, no, that's a great exercise. And I love the simplicity of the takeaways. I could see going into that, maybe thinking there'd be 30 things that you get, but to have those two really clear ones is I guess, really powerful.
Yeah, it blows away. It just blows away.
Yeah. I'm curious on the embracing the roles, especially at a place like Nebraska, where, you know, every recruit was, you know, probably the best player in their state or in their, definitely in their county. What about the players who aren't on the court, you know, who come in and went from being the best to being a second teamer? How do you get them to embrace their roles?
I mean, you get them to build relationships, you know, and buy into the common goals the team sets. And, you know, eventually you don't want to let anybody down if you actually develop, you know, a real connection with people. And then you have to decide, you know, through exercises too. You know, I always talk to teams about the ingredients of championship teams. And one of them is those that accept their roles the best or embrace their roles. And they're like, okay. Because that's true of everywhere. A lot of times I like teams to set their core values. Like, what I have them have a second scorecard that says, this is what I want to be known for. This is what our team wants to look like. And that helps people embrace their roles. If they say, you know, we want to be the team that's the most, has the most positive energy, you know, then I'll say, well, let's talk about what that looks like. What's it look like on the court? What's the role of the bench players on a positive energy team? You know, because that's pretty powerful. If you ask most teams, you know, what does the bench look like? The great energy teams. And, you know, Nebraska, in that same 15 year, we had a phrase called bring the energy or bring the E. And they had agreed at the end of the year they would never lose the energy battle after they got upset a couple of in a weekend, and they lost the energy battle. And, you know, I asked a team in high school, it works in high school, there's a team called Scott Catholic here who just won their sixth state championship this last week, heart in a row. And they wanted to be known as the most positive energy team in the state. So a couple of years ago, I challenged them to stand on every single point of every single play all week at state. I said, it'll never happen. You can't do it. Every time when it's 1-0 and our team scores, can you all stand and celebrate? Because in high school, they sit. At least in college, they're already standing. So it takes energy to stand. And they, for every single point on every single play for 3 days, the entire bench stood and cheered. And you ask the team how powerful that is. They've still been doing it for 3 straight years. They do it in the entire season. They never have a play where they don't stand and cheer. And so, you know, you get embracing your roles because you get them to buy into a team. And you know, and if the culture is built that way, then those kids will stay, right? I can tell you the best example, you know, actually was at Creighton. It was in 2016, the year they made the Elite Eight. They had a kid that was a 3-year starter, and she was going into her senior year. And was great. It was Big East honors all over the place. And gets to her senior year, and she gets beat out by a kid named Taryn Cloth, who's now at LSU playing beach volleyball. Yeah. She was a first-team All-American. But she got beat out, you know, Jess did. And how she handled that had everything to do with how that team finished that year. She could have broke the team apart. I mean, she was a captain. She had, you know, was a brilliant player. She turned into a great scout team player, was awesome every time she was called into play and when she was needed. And was she devastated? Probably. I bet she was as a competitor. But she knew the importance of embracing your role. And I still believe to this day that had everything to do with them making the Elite Eight that year, was the way she handled that situation.
That was part one of our interview with Dr. Larry Widman. Join us next week for more lessons, and be sure to pick up his book, Max Out Mindset.